tonight we're going to look at some more material from chapter 3 and then try to spend some time on what I think is a really interesting theme in Jeremiah, and really in Jeremiah and Hosea, to some extent Isaiah too, but Jeremiah and Hosea is really, like, I think, a good place to look at it. The notion that there are cosmic and earth-wide consequences to sinful behavior. I want to try to sort of understand those verses and also think about whether and how they might or might not be helpful for our own thinking about the moment that we live in. We ended with essentially God's request, God's really better invitation to Israel, despite everything, to return. Shuva mishuva Yisrael, right? And then lo apil panai bachem, I will not look upon you in fierce anger. But what's interesting, is that what comes next is this really striking caveat, or juxtaposition at least, where on the one hand, there's this invitation to repentance and invitation to return. And at the same time, Jeremiah says in verse 13, Ach di'i avonech, only recognize, acknowledge your sin. Ki badunai Elohaich pashat, because you have sinned against the Lord your God. And then a difficult phrase, Vatifazriat rachaich, you've scattered your ways, lezarim, among strangers. Tachat kol etz ra'anan, under every leafy tree, uvekoli lo shamatem ne'um Hashem. And to my voice, you have not paid heed. What I think is striking about the relationship between verse 12 and verse 13 is that you have here a striking relational juxtaposition. And you could imagine actually many earthly, many human interpersonal versions of this. On the one hand, I want you back and I want to give this another shot. On the other hand, you've got to acknowledge what you did wrong. Both of those things are true simultaneously. Walter Brueggemann, I find this formulation a tiny bit idiosyncratic, but I think it's nevertheless helpful. Walter Brueggemann, a Bible scholar I've quoted before, talks about how the prophet wants to articulate the anguish of God on the one hand wanting a relation, and on the other hand, quote, a God who will not relinquish his self-regard. I find that a little bit, again, idiosyncratic. It's not really self-regard that's at stake here. It's actually a desire for a relational acknowledgement. But I think that tension is really real and important here. And what I find moving, actually, is that the text does not pretend to resolve it. Or maybe it's not the kind of thing that needs to be resolved. But it's just a striking pairing of, please come back, and but you have to acknowledge what you did. Vatifazriat rachaich is difficult. It might mean that instead of following one God, they had lots of shrines with lots of gods and lots of paths going there. Or vatifazriat rachaich might be some kind of idiomatic expression for sexual promiscuity. Now, of course, the latter is the dominant metaphor for the former, as we've seen, right? To say that in a less crazy way, sexual promiscuity is the controlling metaphor we've seen, in fact, for lack of faithfulness and for idolatry. Then we get, after that, to this kind of striking crescendo, I think you could say, in the next verses. We have the following. Shuvu vanim shovavim. Return, rebellious children, Ne'um Adonai, declares God. Ki anochi ba'alti vachem. Because I have... This is really hard to translate. I have espoused you, married you, maybe mastered you, not sure. V'lakachti etchem, I will take you, echad me'ir u'shnayim mi'mishpacha, v'heveti etchem tzion. I will take you, one from a town and two from a city, and bring you to Zion. Now, first of all, just notice, just because literarily I think it's interesting, you have in verse 14 these clashing metaphors. Where, you know, you have these two kind of dominant metaphors in biblical theology, Israel as God's child and Israel as God's spouse. Here, the metaphors clash in a single verse. Shuvu vanim shovavim, return, O rebellious children, because I have married you. That's a very strange biblical verse, a very strange bringing together of these metaphors. What ba'alti et bachem really means is not clear to me. I think it's not totally clear, but one play that I think is obvious here is God is saying, I and not Baal am your Baal. I and not the Baal, not this idolatrous God, am really your husband. Now, what I can't solve here and won't pretend to is the starkly patriarchal resonances of a statement like this, which is the Baalti also has the implication of master. It is very much a patriarchal understanding of marriage. There's a lot of discussion about exactly what one from a town and two from a clan means. It sounds a little bit like the idea of a saving remnant that we find in Isaiah. In other words, only a few from each place will survive to return. Although, interestingly, in a new commentary on Jeremiah, a Bible scholar for whom I have a lot of respect, John Goldengate, tries to argue that the one and two here do not, despite the way it's usually read, imply only a small number, but rather on there being representatives from every town and every extended family or clan. I still feel like one from here and two from there does sound like it's numerical and not just expansive. People follow the two options for how to read this. One is to say this, the emphasis is on there's very few who will survive. And the other is to say, no, the emphasis is on God is taking someone from everywhere. It's a kind of expansiveness. I don't know. The traditional reading still strikes me as sort of more convincing here, at least for the moment. V'natati lachem ro'im kilibi v'ra'u etchem de'a v'haskel. Shepherds, unlike the ones in chapter 2, verse 8 that we saw, who did not guide them right, here, shepherds, seemingly an allusion to leaders. The three main connotations, scholars argue, of the image of shepherds are feeding, protecting, and leading. And here the emphasis, I think, is on the third one. They will lead you, they will lead you to pasture with knowledge and skill. And then comes what I meant by calling this a crescendo. This remarkable statement, V'hayaki tirbu ufritem ba'aretz, and when you increase and multiply in the land, no, bayamim ha'hema ne'um Adonai, in those days, says God, lo yomru od aron brit Adonai, people shall no longer speak of the Ark of the Covenant, v'lo ya'ale alev, and they will not even think of the Ark of the Covenant, v'lo yiskeruvo, they will not mention it, v'lo yivkodu v'lo yaseod, and they will not miss it, and they will not make another. This is really interesting. On the one hand, you can say that certain biblical texts worry that the Israelites have an almost like magical, fetishistic kind of relationship with the Ark. And so Jeremiah doesn't like that. It's possible that the original Ark had been removed from the temple, which it was what it sounds like in some biblical texts and not others. Many people think it had probably already been destroyed by the Babylonians. But the theological point here is, I think, really striking. It seems to me that what it is saying here is that the Ark, which holds the commandments in it, will not be needed because the law will be fully internalized. In the language of Jeremiah 31, that we may or may not get a chance to look at in this course, the law will be written upon their heart. The Ark as the throne of God will not be needed because, as we'll see in the next verse, Jerusalem as a whole will be considered the divine throne. There is a kind of, I guess I want to say, an almost messianic vision here. There is a sense that despite all the judgment and the often harsh and even brutal judgment of the book of Jeremiah, there is a vision here of extremely robust restoration. That is, God's hunger for restoring the relationship with Israel ultimately wins in some sense, I think. The phrase bayamim hahema, in those days, is important because in those days sounds like not soon. Meaning there's still a lot of suffering to go through. The judgment remains real. But in those days, right, in the future, it will all be made better. This is not permanent. The situation between God and the people is not, the troubled situation between God and the people is not permanent. And then we get to verse 17, Ba'etahi yikru'uli Yerushalayim kisei Adonai. They will call, in those days, at that time, they will call Jerusalem the throne of God. V'nigvu elea chol agoyim, and all the nations shall come together there, l'shem Adonai, l'Yerushalayim, will assemble there in Jerusalem in the name of God. V'lo yelchu od acharei shrirut libam hara. They will not follow the stubbornness of their own evil hearts. Just to make sure, I realize I said something a minute ago that may not have been clear, may have assumed a kind of insider information in a way, which is that the ark was often conceived of as God's throne. And the idea of the new age is that almost that God's throne is almost dissipated out so that it's Jerusalem as a whole that manifests God's presence and not this particular object called an ark. Bayamim hahema, in those days, yelchu veit Yehuda al beit Yisrael, v'yavou yachdav me'eretz tzafon al ha'aretz asher inchalti et avotechem. In those days, the house of Judah will go together with the house of Israel, and they will come together from the north. Remember, the threat in this book is all about the north, which is stand-in for Babylonia. They will come back the land that I have shown them, that I have given them to make a possession of. Here, if you are a historically minded scholar, what you're going to say is that this verse, at least, and probably whatever you determine the unit that this verse is a part of, is spoken when both kingdoms need to be brought back. So you're talking after 587 BCE. Can you nod if you follow what I just said? Meaning, the idea that you're going to bring both Judah and Israel back means that both kingdoms have been destroyed. That's not how this text positions when this is spoken. But if you're a historically minded scholar, you're going to assume that that's in fact when this was spoken. The word yachdav there, I think, is also probably important. It means, you have a sense there that it means, first of all, everyone's coming back, and there'll be no conflict between them. It's togetherness, but it's also the sheer numerical abundance of them. And then comes a kind of another divine soliloquy where God begins to lament how painful this has been for God. And again, I think it's important, we've talked about this, and I won't belabor this again tonight, but to reveal that God, that the God who is involved here, even in this judgment, which at times seems, as we've talked about, quite brutal, is a God of love and faithfulness, and a God who is hurting fundamentally, wounded, as we've talked about. Va'anochi amarti eich ashitech babanim, va'etein lach eretz chemda nachalat tzvi tzivot goyim, va'omar avi tikrei li, u'me'acharai lo tashuvi. I don't really know how to translate Eich Ashitech, to be honest. Vabanim, JPS translation, I'd resolve to adopt you as my child, okay, and to give you a desirable land, the fairest heritage of all the nations, and then comes this really pathos-filled, and I was convinced that you would call me father and never turn away from me. It's an extraordinarily poignant verse where you have essentially God as the wounded father whose dreams have been broken. One of the things I find interesting about this verse that I need to research and think about more is, I have said before in a variety of settings, and I still think this is basically true, that the reason non-Israelites are never called God's children in the Bible is because the word ben is fundamentally covenantal in biblical thinking. And yet, here, Eich Ashitech Babanim sounds like all the nations are called God's sons, which I find interesting, because I think that's rare. An example of what I'm talking about is at the end of the book of Jonah, where God comes unbelievably close to saying, every human being in the world is my child, but ends up saying instead, every human being in the world is my creation. Jonah gets mad at God, and God says, What are you mad at me? You know, you're upset that a plant got destroyed. How am I supposed to punish How am I supposed to turn on these people whom I made? It's very close to saying that they're God's children, but it doesn't use that language. Okay? Now, but what happened to God's dreams? Achein bagda isha mere'a. Kein begadetem bi beit Yisrael ne'um Hashem. Just as a woman breaks faith with a lover, so have you broken faith with me. There again, you moved from my sons to my wife very quickly. Now, this is going to be a segue for next week. Kol al shvayim nishma. Listen, on the bare heights is heard b'chi tachanunei b'nei Yisrael, the suppliant weeping of the people of Israel. Ki he'evu et darkam, because they have gone a twisted way. Shachichu et Adonai Elohim, and they have forgotten the Lord their God. The weeping here seems to be the weeping of Israel, but some scholars, not a lot, some scholars actually think that this is God crying. As we'll see when we look at passages from chapter 4 and in chapter 9 next week, there are places where it seems less ambiguous to me that it's God crying. But here, it may be God crying. Now, if you're wondering, how can it be God crying when it says, B'chi tachanunei b'nei Yisrael? Some people think that means weeping for God's children, not weeping by God's children. Because they have gone a crooked way and ignored the Lord your God, their God. Shuvu vanim shovavim erpam shuvotechem. Turn back, oh rebellious children, I will heal your, then meshuvotechem, either your afflictions or your rebellions. And there, I wonder again whether that is actually deliberate. The ambiguity there serves the idea that your afflictions are a function of your rebellions. They're the natural consequences of your rebellions. I will heal your afflictions or your rebellions. And healing here, we should just say, healing is a stronger term than forgiveness. Not just I will forgive you, but I will make you other than you are. And we'll see later in Jeremiah that will become an important idea to him, that Israel's heart will be transformed, not merely that it will be forgiven. What then comes as the end of this chapter is all of a sudden we get a confession from Israel of their sins and their mistreatment of God. And it's a little hard to know exactly what this is doing here. Is it ironic? Is it didactic, that is explaining to Israel what authentic repentance would look like? Is it really there for people who are already in exile to have a model? Is it momentary? There's a lot of different possibilities. Is it duplicitous and manipulative? All of those are possible. But let's just look briefly at what it is that they say. So we're beginning in the middle of verse 22. Hinenu atanu lach ki ata Adonai Eloheinu. We come to you because you, God, are our Lord. You, Lord, are our God. Achein lasheker migvaot hamon harim. Achein ba'Adonai Eloheinu tshuat Yisrael. Nothing useful comes from the hills. Screaming loudness comes from the mountains, but our salvation comes only from God. Hamon harim is a hard phrase. JPS translates confusion from the mountains. Robert Alter translates the clamor of the mountains. The idea, I think, might be the worship that they offer at the shrines and the hills was just so much noise. Only God could save us. And then they say this really interesting thing, the haboshet achla et yegia avotenu. But the shameful thing, which is a euphemism for the Baal, has consumed all of the efforts of our ancestors. Minu ureinu, ever since we were kids. Et sonam bet bekaram, their flocks and their herds, et beneam bet noteam, their sons and their daughters. By the way, just to be clear, the substitution in the prophets of Boshet for Baal is a way of emphasizing, of course, just what a disgrace worshiping the Baal was considered to be, what a degrading thing it was that Israel worships that. Now, what may be going on is that the Israelites are being given a script for what it would mean to fully own up to their failure. The idea is that not only have they offered up their flocks and their herds as sacrifices, but they've even sacrificed their children to the Baal. Okay, there's been child sacrifice. Nishkeva v'voshtenu, let us lie down in our shame. U'techasenu klimatenu, let our disgrace be our blanket. Let our disgrace cover us. Ki ladonai Eloheinu chatanu, because to the Lord our God we have sinned. Anachnu v'avotenu minureinu v'ad hayom hazeh, we and our fathers from our youth until this very day. V'lo shamanu b'kol adonai Eloheinu, we have not listened to the voice of the Lord our God. This is quite a striking ending and very unusual one. And there are at least, as I think I offered, five or six possibilities of how we should read this. I like the idea of there being scripted, but I also think the text doesn't really say, meaning it's very abrupt. In the middle of verse 22, we have this shift, and we're not really given any narration about what's going on here. So what I want to think about now is something that happens in the next chapter. We already saw what may be an allusion to it in this chapter, but the idea that Israel's sins will lead or do lead to disastrous consequences. And I have a lot that I wanted to say that is sort of like big picture on this, but I think maybe we should start by looking at the verses, okay? So here's what Jeremiah says. We're gonna go from verse 23 to verse 28 in chapter 4. Ra'iti et ha'aretz, v'hinei tohu v'avohu, ve'el ha'shamayim, ve'ein oram. I look at the earth, and it is, phrase familiar to you, no doubt, tohu v'avohu, it is whatever that means, chaotic and something. And I look to the skies, and their light has disappeared. I'm going to just read the whole unit, and then we'll talk about it. Ra'iti heharim v'hinei ro'ashim. I look at the mountains, and they are quaking. V'chol hagva'ot hitkalkalu, and all of the hills are swaying back and forth. Ra'iti v'hinei ein ha'adam, v'chol of hashamayim nadadu. I look, and there is no humans, and all of the birds of the sky have flown away. Ra'iti v'hinei ha'karmel hamidbar, v'chol arav nitsu mipnei Adonai, mipnei charon apo. I look, and the farmland is now a desert, and all of its towns have been laid to ruin because of God, because of God's extreme anger. Kicho amar Adonai, shemamatia kol haaretz, v'chala lo eseh. Because so said the Lord, the whole earth, the whole land, the whole aretz shall be desolate, but I will not destroy it utterly. Alzot te'eval haaretz, v'kadru hashamayim mima'al, al-kidibarti, zamoti v'lo nichamti v'lo ashuv mimena. For this the earth mourns. Not sure that's what te'eval means, but I'll get there in a second. And the skies above have turned black. Because I have spoken, I have planned, and I will not turn back and go back from it. You have here, in a very obvious way, Yirmiyahu drawing upon Genesis 1 to argue that all of creation suffers as a consequence of human wrongdoing. You could argue, in fact, that this poem is a step-by-step dismantling, deconstruction of the created world. It's a really dramatic and powerful image. Lewis Stuhlman, who's an academic who spent his whole career on the book of Jeremiah, describes this as the most stunning piece in the entire book of Jeremiah. What we're saying, in other words, is that according to this book, there is some kind of inextricable relationship between moral behavior and what happens in creation. But, and this is the hard part, the exact nature of that relationship, just how sin affects creation, is not clear at all, or at least is not made obvious. So I wanted to share with you one modern scholar's take on this. Richard Bauckham is a New Testament scholar, but who's written a lot on ecology and the Bible. And he makes this following comment that I think is interesting. Human evil has ecological consequences. As Walter Brueggemann puts it, covenantal Israel held the staggering notion that human conduct matters for the well-being of creation. This idea coheres with the Hebrew Bible's strong sense of a created order by which relationships in the community of creation should be ordered. Humans are the disorderly factor in the world, disrupting its harmony and its natural rhythms, with destructive consequences both for humans themselves and for other creatures. Sometimes the prophets can speak of these consequences of human evil as the direct interventions of God in judgment. Sometimes, as though they are processes built into the order of creation as God has created it. The two, this is now Bauckham talking as a modern, the two are not necessarily in contradiction. The prophets understood that the behavior of humans and the well-being of the rest of creation are intimately interconnected, but they did not, of course, have the scientific understanding of the connections that modern ecology is giving us. On the whole, we have become aware of such connections only as our ignoring of them has led to consequences too considerable to be ignored. Now, I am a little uncertain about how quickly we should leap from the assumption that moral failing leads to cosmic consequence to Bauckham's modern ecological reading. Only because I don't want to bypass trying to figure out what the Bible's own understanding of that causal nexus is, right? I feel there's a little bit of a kind of, oh, well, we know that human greed causes, you know, the depletion of the ozone layer. We know, you know, and whatever. I'm still not certain how the Bible understands the relationship between these two things. It still leaves me, I will say, puzzled. You could even say that the picture here a little bit sounds like an apocalypse, right? That is a kind of destruction of the world as a whole. However, it is also historical. I think what you're getting here is that this destruction of the world is focused on destruction in the land of Israel. At least that's how I'm reading 27. Ki cho amar Adonai shemamatiye kol haaretz v'chala lo eseh, which Jeremiah has already used that phrase multiple times to refer to his non-willing, God will not destroy the world, God will not destroy Israel entirely. So there's a kind of merging here of the kind of apocalyptic and the historical. But it culminates in the destruction of Judah and Jerusalem. And when by the time you get to 28, Azote Val Haaretz, I'm not sure. I'm going to take back what I was going to say. The ambiguity of Aretz, meaning either land or earth, is wonderfully suggestive here, but also makes this whole text very elusive. With that said, let me actually try to now read this through with a little bit more detail. So let's look at all the connections between this and Genesis 1. First of all, of course, as we already saw, tohu vavohu. Second of all, the elimination of light in verse 23b. Creation gets started with the creation of light, so no light seems like a clear reversal. Ra'iti vihine, I saw and behold, or vayara Elohim, and the constant vihine, Vayar Elohim v'hinei tov me'od. Ra'iti et ha'aretz ve'el ha'shamayim in verse 23 is a reversal of shamayim and aretz in Bereishit. And I wonder whether that reversal is actually supposed to be significant. Again, signaling the reversal of creation that we have here. And then, by the way, if you want to go even further, v'hinei ein ha'adam could be an allusion to Adam Ayin in Genesis chapter 2. And there's more arguments people make. I think they're more tenuous. But there's a lot of seemingly clear connections between this and Genesis. So somehow there is a creational undoing that flows from human sin. Literally, Ra'iti, the fourfold repetition of I looked, makes it almost haunting and gives you a haunting picture of the sheer devastation that will likely follow. It is striking, I think, by the way, that a text about chaos is so intricately and perfectly structured poetically. There is something really interesting about that. Yet another way of putting this, I know I'm belaboring this point, but I'm talking around this point because I don't know exactly how to say it. Covenant and creation are so connected that you can't assault one without the other becoming undone also. Vihine, I think, is interesting because hine literally means something like lo or behold. And I think that here it's supposed to kind of express the sheer surprise at the extremity of the destruction. I looked and, oh my God, tohu vavohu. I looked and whoa, right? It's that kind of sense. That's what the work that Vihine is doing here. And to be clear, I think in verse 25, the statement, there is no man and there are no birds, is an expression for all life has gone. In other words, he started Ra'iti et ha'aretz, that's verse 23, I saw the land, parallel to that in verse 25, there's no man. And I looked at the skies, parallel to that, there's no birds, meaning it's all gone. Shmamatiye kol ha'aretz v'chalalo e'eseh. Chalalo e'eseh is really interesting because it doesn't seem to fit. And it's almost like one of the things I find so striking about this book is it can't control itself. Like, it's talking about total devastation, and then almost by reflex it says, but not total, total devastation. V'chalalo eseh. I'm not going to totally destroy it. Here's an example of a kind of source critical reading I find unhelpful, right? I'm going to quote from a source critical observation made about the phrase v'chalalo eseh. Since this claim stands in such tension with what precedes and follows, we may need to acknowledge the possibility that the sentence is a later addition, drawn from elsewhere. Okay, great. I'm happy to acknowledge that. But I also have a text in front of me that actually refuses to say that the destruction will be total, total, but only almost total. So I think there's actually something very important here. There's almost like a prediction here of what Jeremiah will be told in chapter 32, which is you should buy a field in the land that is about to be destroyed because houses and fields will again be bought there. Another form of scholarly cheating, one modern scholar decides, this is so surprising that we should change the aleph in lo to a hey, and read it as v'chala la e'eseh, and total destruction I will make for it. Except there's no textual manuscripts that suggest that, and just editing texts because you find there are tensions in them seems like a bad literary strategy to me. In other words, we should actually deal with the fissures and the cracks rather than trying to pave over them. In other texts, the intercession of a prophet like Moses or Amos brings about a divine relenting, a change of mind on God's part, or a change of heart on God's part. But in Jeremiah, it seems like the breaching of covenant is so extreme that that won't work. And as we'll see when we see the temple sermon, God will explicitly prohibit Jeremiah from trying to intercede on Israel's behalf. The transition from this global picture to what's clearly a national picture, the transition from the entire cosmos to the military invasion of Judah is striking here. So if someone asks you, is the vision of destruction Jeremiah sees here, is it local and national? The answer is yes, it's both of those things. And it's precisely, you know, the nexus of them that matters so much. So let's go to Hosea chapter 4 for a minute, where you'll see this really striking passage, where, just to give you some context here, Hosea is making a declaration, essentially, that everything that possibly could have gone wrong in the world has gone wrong. People's relationship with God and with each other are both totally damaged. And, again, to what Ellen and I have just been talking about, this threatens to bring the whole world to total disaster. And here, by the way, here's Baucom again. What can only seem grossly hyperbolic in its original context looks only too realistic in the context of our own situation of worldwide ecological catastrophe. Here's what Hosea says. Shimu devar Adonai b'nei Yisrael. Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel. Ki riv l'Adonai im yoshvei ha'aretz. For God has an argument with the dwellers of the land. Those of you who are interested in biblical studies will note that the word "reeve" is hugely controversial in biblical studies. Some people think it's a specific formula of a lawsuit that God brings against the people. Other people are more skeptical about whether that always means that. But God has a conflict, a case against the dwellers of the land. Why? Ki ein emet ve'ein chesed ve'ein dat Elohim ba'aretz. Because there is no, whatever emet means, truthfulness, honesty, faithfulness, no chesed, no love, no goodness. All, if you look in scholarship on the book of Hosea, there is tremendous conversation and debate about what each of these terms means in general and here. Ve'ein da'at Elohim, and there is no knowledge of God in the land. What da'at Elohim means in Hosea is also a subject of huge controversy. Abraham Joshua Heschel, I think probably wrongly, tried to argue that Da'at Elohim means understanding God's pathos. I don't know exactly what it means, but what you have here in verse 1 at least are sins of omission, let's just say. I also just want to observe that I think the lack of emet and chesed can probably be taken as symptoms of the lack of Da'at Elohim. Not knowing God manifests in not instantiating God's attributes, not making God's attributes part of what we governs our life. Now, from verse 1, which are sins of omission, we go to verse 2, which are sins of commission. Alo v'chachesh v'ratzoach v'ganov v'na'of, false swearing, dishonesty, and murder, theft, and adultery. This is like all five of the Ten Commandments in five words, right? B'damim b'damim naga'u, and literally, better than crime follows upon crime, bloodshed touches upon bloodshed. I mean, that's a much more violent image than just crime follows upon crime. Interestingly, by the way, Hosea, I mentioned this last time, Hosea, like Jeremiah, his primary emphasis is not on social sin. His primary emphasis is actually on sins of idolatry and lack of covenantal faithfulness. And those in turn manifest themselves in rampant social sin. In other words, you could say that verse 2 is a description for Hosea of the social consequences and the social manifestations of turning away from God. But then comes verse 3, which is what ties this to the passage in Jeremiah that we were talking about. Al kein te'eval ha'aretz. For that, the earth is withered. V'umlal kol yoshevba, and everything that dwells on it is suffering. B'chayata sadeh uve'of ha'shamayim v'gam digei ayam ye'asefu. It's very hard to translate that, much harder than you would think, I think. B'chayata sadeh, beasts of the field, or among them are beasts of the field, and birds of the sky, or perhaps are among them are birds of the sky, and also the fish of the sea die. The Al Kain here is the discussion that Ellen and I were just having. It's exactly what is the logic of Al Kain. What is the therefore? What is the meaning of the therefore? Nature suffers. Humans are responsible for the failure of the created world to function. That, I think, is right. And I think, again, in verse 3, as in Jeremiah, we have some kind of process of uncreation. You have a flow here. Faithlessness towards God leads to human relational breakdown, which leads to eventually, perhaps unavoidable, terrible consequences for all living creatures. When humans mistreat each other, eventually even the birds and the fish pay a price. Again, this Alcaine is interesting because it raises that question of, is this a punishment or a natural consequence? You could argue here, and again, notice here that there's a decision not to describe God as the subject. The subject here is the land. The land withers. Te'eval, for those of you who like this kind of thing, Aleph Bet Lamed has two meanings in the BDB. One is to mourn and the other is to dry up and wither. So take your pick. I suspect both meanings may be intended here. But it seems like there might be some internal correspondence between human actions and the negative consequences that they bring, and that those consequences are built into creation itself in some sense. You can't do X without Y happening. When human beings pay, when human beings go astray enough, they can't but yield ecological consequences. I brought a passage from Walter Brueggemann that I think is interesting, where he says here, I suggest that the poem carefully and deliberately mumbles over the relation between Decalogue and creation. It does not want to reduce this connection to a formula, and it does not want to identify an agent. It wants, however, to insist upon a crucial, devastating connection. That is, I think, a really provocative and interesting reading of this unit. But I did want to also mention that in recent scholarship, kind of ecologically minded biblical scholarship, people have started to argue that you can't understand, I'm not sure I fully understand what this means, I want to say biblically, but how do I say this? You can't understand the earth's role in the Bible well unless you see the earth itself having agency. And what this scholar, Melissa Loya, actually argues is that no, Brueggemann is essentially not right here. The text does not mumble over the relation between Decalogue and creation. It says that earth brings about the devastation. Earth is the agent here. When earth sees what goes on, it causes the languishing of all of creation. But of course, what that means is that a metaphor or not a metaphor? A little hard to say. If I've made you a little dizzy here, I apologize. I think that the point here, what I had hoped to bring across here is, here is a really interesting case where we see that human actions matter, and that they matter perhaps in a far more subtle way than if you do this, I will do that, but rather that they matter in the sense of, if you will do this, this will ineluctably happen. And that that's the way God created the world to be, with this kind of interpenetration or something like that, radical interdependence of all things. There was a time when biblical scholars talked endlessly about how the God of the Bible is the God of history. But the truth is that in these texts, in Jeremiah and in Hosea, it's clear that God is no less, and perhaps even more fundamentally, the God of creation. And that the violation of covenant doesn't just lead to damaging consequences in history. It leads to some kind of undoing of the very fabric of creation itself. And that is really, I think, important and interesting. It's also the case, by the way, this is really a footnote, that a God of creation also makes for more interesting dialectics between the universal and the particular than a God purely of covenant and history.